Good morning. Good morning. I appreciate the fact that you all woke up for the session. It's much appreciated, and I'm going to do my best to keep you awake for this session. One of the things that you may have heard was that unfortunately the other speaker in the other invited talk canceled. That was Jim Reed. He couldn't be here. He was going to give a talk. And so you don't feel cheated by that. I've modified my talk to include all of his material as well. So I should be doing the talk enum. Yes, it's a new and exciting technology, and I think you're really going to want to hear about it. Oh, look, ambiance. Yes, well, now that we're here together. Okay, so as Lee said, my name is David Blank Edelman. I am the Director of Technology, which is actually not literally on the faculty, but I get to play with them at Northeastern University. And also Lisa, Program Chair, and we'll talk about that later for sure. So what I want to do first before I go any further, and I think it's pretty important that I do that, I have a warning for you, and I am very, very, very serious about this warning. This talk will include mature language, mature sexual situations, and some audience nudity. Okay, maybe not any audience nudity. I appreciate that. I appreciate I suppose one could simply leave your name and your phone number, and we'll see what we can do to match you up using technology or something. But I'm actually serious. So it is the case that I will be talking about things if words like clitoris and fellatio are problematic to you, you should go somewhere else. I'm totally serious. We'll be using those in a serious way now. I make jokes about this sort of stuff, but I just want to make it clear, if there are any children in the audience, you know, make sure they cover their parents' ears, okay? That's all I ask. Okay, number two, I am making an attempt in this talk not to assume that things are hetero or gender normal, okay? And I made up this cool little symbol, this H-pipe, G-pipe, N-pipe thing to indicate that. I can tell you that as I went through and read a lot of the literature and stuff like that, and even the people in the field think that there's a lot of stuff that is heteronormal in the sex therapy community and how they think about things. When they talk about, oh, you know, what is sex to them, that usually is sort of heteronormal defined. It's usually, you know, vaginal penile insertion stuff. So I will tell you when I have distinctly noticed that that is the case, and I will attempt to not use that terminology or do that. But I want to point out that this is one of these things that I'm steeped in too in this culture. So if I get it wrong, I apologize already, and I will make every attempt. Now, the other thing that I think you should be aware of is I'm not either a provider or a consumer of sex therapy, as far as I know. So what you hear from me comes from my research, my talking to sex therapists. But if you have a problem, I wouldn't recommend telling me during the question and answers session. I don't have a doctor after my name. I can't help you in that regard. Okay. And finally, here's the biggie. This talk, strange enough, will be primarily about debugging. Now, I know you guys all came for the sex, but really what I'm interested in focusing on, look, and people are leaving already once I said that. Yeah, okay. Well, don't worry, you know, someday you'll need the stuff and it'll be here. So, okay. Now, the thing that I wanted, let me start with this. How many folks here have actually gone to my previous talks here at LISA? Wow, that's a really wonderful ego stroke. Well then, you know that what I'm primarily concerned with when I'm looking at these things is I think, well, self, because, you know, what else are you going to say to yourself? How can we find places in system administration that need strengthening, that we need to be paying attention to, but how can we do it, the lazy way, I guess is what I would say. How can we do it so that we can learn from other people and other professions and stuff like that? And that's where these things come from. I've been focusing primarily on things like communication issues, been focusing on things like diagnostic, you know, how do you become a better diagnostician? How do we teach diagnosticians? In this particular case, it occurred to me as a result of a previous talk that we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the debugging stuff. You know, people in programming languages think about debugging, but system in field, I haven't seen so much. And I'd like to change that. Okay, so here's the question. Why system administration and sex therapy? Why am I putting these two things together? Well, you know, it certainly draws a crowd. You have to admit that. you know, and but that's not primarily why I do it. I assert that our debugging tasks are getting harder. I assert that the complexity and the difficulty of the things that we're being asked to debug are increasing over time and at a rapid pace, such that it's getting a little nuts. So we better be keeping pace with that, in my opinion. I also assert that these days, debugging is not, for us, necessarily binary. Now, I don't know if it ever has been, where it's this case where something either works or doesn't work, and your job is to make it go from the doesn't work to the work category. I'm not clear if that's ever been the case, but for sure, nowadays, it's things like performance, you know, are things going well? All of my packets getting there? Sometimes some of them are getting there, stuff like that. So they're not just binary, and we have to pay attention to not just works, doesn't work. So our level of what we have to look at, bless you, is got to be a little more sophisticated. And there are a couple of things, at least, that the two fields share in common that I'm going to try to bring to your attention. One is that both of our fields have to deal with very complex systems. These complex systems are often not A, stuff we wrote or we have direct control over, you know, we wrote and we know directly how it works. These things are B, not necessarily things that we have direct control over. Maybe I have control over my client, but I might not have control over your server. And C, you know, they're often talking to each other, and they have to work with each other, okay? The other thing that I find that also comes up between our two fields is that there's a notion in both that it should just work, okay? Let me give you an example of that in sex. In fact, let's spend a little time with sex because, you know, that'll keep you awake, among other things. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me talk a little bit about why I think they're getting harder first before we talk about sex because... Yeah, there we go. I hope people know what that clip art is. You know, I looked at it and said, well, people recognize that's Humpty Dumpty. So, okay. So here's why I think it's getting harder. First off, things are getting, as I told you, more complex, but I think things are also getting more interdependent as time goes on, okay? It is the case that this depends on this, that depends on this, and now all of a sudden, if Amazon is down and I can't buy my copy of Ping the Duck, you know, my whole business comes to a grinding halt or something, you know? Or, you know, if my RAID controller isn't talking to this, you know, it's a problem. And there's more distributed dependency. Now it's not just the fact that the things in my machine room are having problems. It's the things in my machine room are having trouble reaching somebody else's machine room or data center or whatever. Okay? And I think that's making it more complex. And I know that I spend a lot more time dealing with stuff associated with that. We don't control all the parts, as I said, and we haven't written all the software. Okay. Once upon a time, it might have been possible to say, "Well, yeah, I wrote that daemon. I know what it does." Okay. But now, you know, I didn't write bind. I'm not going to write bind, but yet I have to understand bind in some regards. And here's perhaps a controversial stance, and I don't want you to think that I'm anti-open source because I'm not. I'm at an educational institution. We love open source and free things. For sure. But my assertion is that even though source code availability is increasing for a lot of things, it's helping us less and less. Okay, great. So I'm having a problem. I can go look at how the Linux VM scheduler works. Oh, great. That's great. That's exactly what I have time to do is try to figure out how that works. Or go, you know, dig, you know, looking through the kernel code, okay? Really lovely, but so what? You know, and so I think the fact, you know, as these systems are getting harder, even though we have the ability to figure out what's going on, it's helping us less and less, my opinion. Okay, so here's the question. How should sex just work? And these are some things by Dr. Spence, who said, here are some of the prevalent, you can decide if they're myths. And this is going to be, again, this is going to be, I should have marked this as hetero and gender normal as well. Here we go. Here are things that are, for most people, true. All other couples have sexual intercourse several times a week. Sure, we all know that, right? Sex for all other couples includes orgasm on every single occasion, not just, you know, federal holidays. All other couples are able to have their orgasms simultaneously. We all know how that works. Works same time. Everybody happy, same time. No issues. Okay. If sex is not good, there must be something wrong with the relationship generally. Right? This is what people think. Partners should instinctively know what type of stimulation their partner needs. Because we all have body parts. You know, you should just know. Okay? Or if a partner does not respond sexually to his or her partner, then he or she does not find that partner sexually attractive. Okay? Some of these things you have in your own head. I'm willing to bet. I do. Okay? Now, let's play this game and look at the two different genders. Okay? How about for men under, you know, certain... Yeah, okay, I'm just waffling here, but this is coming out of the literature. I think it was 1991. Okay? So, first off, for men, physical contact must always lead to sex. If it doesn't, well, you know, it's bad, or, you know, it's just wrong or broken or something happened. Sexual activity involves a steady and fixed path which must always end in orgasm. I'm working my way over here, and here's orgasm, and I must run up here, and that's what sex consists of. Okay, I hope that was good for you as good as for me, okay? Okay? Sexual activity should always involve intercourse. If it doesn't, it's not sex. The male should take charge and make the first moves in sex. If they're not, there's a problem. Men should always know instinctively how to be sexually competent, and enjoyable sex must be natural and spontaneous. I'm sorry, is it for you? Is that what you're saying? Okay. Second slide. Sex always requires an erection. I mean, how else would you do it, right? That's what people think. Men are no longer influenced by traditional myths about the male role regarding sex. No siree, Bob. We are enlightened now. Men must perform successfully in sex, as in other areas of their lives, it is performance that counts. And we have little metrics, too, you know. Big metrics. Yeah, absolutely, Dan. Thanks. Okay, I'm not going to go there. Men must always desire sex and be capable of responding sexually. If we don't, there's a problem with us. But if it's not always, 24/7, 365, we've got a pager on our hip, you know. And real men should not express certain emotions to their partners. Forbidden. Okay? Now, it's only fair for me to do the women side of this sort of thing. Now, I want to point out here that there are three of those slides. Now, versus two. Now, I don't know, you know, I have my theories as to what it means that people, yes, please. So the question is this men talking about themselves or women talking about men and stuff? This is general myths in the culture as people have identified. Okay? And similarly, what I'm going to do is show you the same thing for the women's side of things. But there are more of them. Now, I have my theories as to why there are more of them. It verges a little bit on the political, so I'll leave that out for a moment. But here we go. Here we go for women. A woman should always take part in sex if her partner makes approaches. That's the way they said it in the book. I think it's kind of weird, but okay. Yep, you must always do it. Man approaches. Okay, or partner approaches. A woman should not make the first sexual moves towards her partner. That would be bad, because we all know what that means, right? It doesn't matter if a woman doesn't have an orgasm, you know, as it doesn't actually serve any reproductive purpose, and or most women don't have orgasms anyway, so what the hell? Doesn't matter. A woman should always be capable of intercourse, even as a passive recipient. If you're not capable, you've got a problem. A woman should not expect her partner to wait until she is sufficiently aroused before penetration begins. Well, I hate that one. I'm going to skip right over it. A woman should be capable of orgasm without requiring manual stimulation of the clitoris. Intercourse should be sufficient. If they're not getting off on that, that's their problem. Respectable women should not demonstrate high levels of enjoyment and excitement, because we all know what that means, right? Respectable women do not communicate their sexual needs and preferences to their partners, because, you know, they wouldn't be able to handle it anyway, I'm sure, you know. Respectable women should not masturbate. No, sorry, Bob, let's not do that. You might find yourself out of a job if you're, say, a surgeon general. Respectable women should not use fantasies during sexual activity with their partner, because we all know that they're not, you know, what that might mean. And respectable women should never have sexual fantasies. Nope, they're having sexual fantasies. Well, what does that mean? One more. In order to be, and this is kind of weird, but it was 1991 when this was written. In order to be a modern woman, this is not written for me. I didn't write this. In order to be a modern woman, I must be able to achieve orgasm. Being able to achieve orgasm is one of the most important things in life. In order to be a modern woman, I must initiate sex with my partner. Okay, that's how you know I'm a modern woman. In order to be a modern woman, I must have premarital sexual relationships. Because, you know, waiting would mean that I'm not all that modern. I'm old, you know, back in the dark ages, wearing a little bonnet and appearing on, you know, Little House on the Prairie or something. In order to be a modern woman, I must give my partner plenty of feedback about my sexual likes and dislikes, whether they like it or not. Okay, so we all know what I've just talked about. Like, there's a problem here, right? So you look at this stuff and you think, oh yeah, well maybe that, you know, like some of that I have kind of in my head, but no, that shouldn't be true. It shouldn't be true. It shouldn't be true. But we all walk around with this stuff. Now my question is, sex should just work, okay? But here's the thing, it doesn't. And in fact, you get books about it, okay? These are both really good books. I'd like the one on the right is kind of an interesting one. You're welcome to go find. One is called Sex Is Not Simple. And the other one is called Sex Is Not a Natural Act by Leonard Tiefer. And it's actually an interesting book of essays that would be worthwhile reading. I didn't bring it with me, but I can show it to you at some point. Now, that was sex. Let's talk about system administration. System administration should just work. Examples, plug and play. Or plug and pray, as it used to be called, certainly in the Bible Belt. Okay, it should just work. It is just SCSI. It's just a SCSI cable. It's just a fiber patch cable. It's just SMTP. It's just DNS. It's just DOS formatted. It's just this. It's just that. You know what I'm talking about, right? When someone says, oh, you know, this should just work. I've got my cable here. And, you know, it's just, it's got VNC in the end. It should just work, right? VNC. Wrong thing. You know what I meant. Okay? The Zero Administration Toolkit. If that's an indicator of anything, and I'm glad that that has died a death, but maybe it should come back. That says, it should just work. Why would you need an administrator? Why would you need administration? It should just work. This holds a special warm spot in my heart. For some reason, people think, because we used to have an abbey full of monks who could, with a little bit of lead time, whip out anything we wanted, it should just be easy. We should just be able to print. And if printing isn't working, I don't know what your problem is, but it should just work. I mean, there's no complexity to printing at all, as we all know. You know, it's really easy. Plus, you know, you just have to get the gold leaf on it. But besides that, that's the hard part, right? And the internet, okay. The internet should just work for some value of the internet work and should, okay. You know, my interweb, you know, the Yahoo is down, you know, that sort of thing, right? It should just work. And here's another one. Watch me be controversial. Of course you can fix that. You have the source, right? No. Okay, others? People in the audience? What else should just work in system administration? Examples? That was a lovely little tone. Other examples of things that people have told you it should just work? Your computer. Yes, Dan's computer should just work. Microsoft should just work. They do a good job. Well, it depends on what you think they should be working at, but they're doing a good job with something. What else should just work? Email. Email should just work. And if it's not working, I mean, there's no complexity here, it should just work. Sir? Spam filters. Yes, absolutely. Why the hell am I getting this spam? Why can't you just make it go away? Let me take one more. The wireless network should just work. Absolutely. Because look at all this air. We should be able to harness it somehow, right? We're all breathing. You're absolutely right. And we all know that these things are a lot more complex. So what I want to do is start talking about debugging. Now, my conception of debugging, and you're going to find it here, is that there's sort of two levels of things we're going to talk about. But what I want to do is draw from both of these books. I have one of them here. I didn't want to bring the other one to save the jet fuel. You know, this is a cool book by David Agins called Debugging, The 9 Indispensable Rules for Finding Even the Most Elusive Software and Hardware Problems. And then there's another book called Debugging by Thinking by Metzger. I forget what his name is, Robert Metzger. Both of them are cool. Both of them were, in fact, published this year. And so I'm going to give you my things from these books that I found cool that will be useful to you. This is standard, ordinary, everyday debugging, okay? We're not yet to what I think is the cool stuff and my challenges to you. But I think if I didn't talk about some of the things that you should know about for debugging from a standard perspective, I wasn't doing my job. Let's start off with the 9 indispensable rules. Rule number one, understand the system. Be able to, you know, be able to read manuals, understand the protocols, et cetera, okay? Fundamentals and stuff like that. Two, make it fail, and we'll talk a little bit about what make it fail means, but you should be able to make whatever the problem you're having problems with fail again so you can see it. Okay? Quick thinking and look. By that means stop theorizing as to what the problem is and start trying to look at it and pay attention to it. Okay? Look at it versus trying to make assumptions. Divide and conquer. If you're trying to figure out where a problem is, you should be able to partition the problem. You should be able to figure out where the problem is not and how to deal with that. Change one thing at a time. Okay? Hopefully you know that already. Okay? Keep an audit trail. Write down what you did. Pay attention to that. Check the plug. Sometimes it's the simple stuff that gets you, and you know that too. Get a fresh view. If you can't figure it out, bring another pair of eyes nearby and explain it to them. And we'll talk about some of that stuff as well. I have more to say about that. And if you didn't fix it, it ain't fixed. Okay? If it happened to have fixed itself, you didn't fix it, and it's not fixed. Now, I'm going to argue in the second half of my talk against that particular line. You're going to see it in a moment. So prepare. I'll get provocative later. Okay. So in the make it fail thing, one of the things that he says, and I'm not going to go through all of these 9 rules, just the ones that I have interesting things or he has interesting things to say about. He says it's important for you to stimulate versus simulate the failure. Okay. What that means is you need to produce the failure in the place you're having the failure so you can look at that. Not you need to be able to take it back to a lab and analyze and try to make the exact same configuration and try to make it fail there. That's not where you want to do it. You want to make the problem where it's happen for you there because it's a different problem in the lab. Okay? Stimulate versus simulate the failure. And to take that home, he uses the following. How many engineers does it take to fix a light bulb? None. They all say, I can't reproduce it. The light bulb in my office works fine. Or rather, light bulb in my, yeah. Okay? And so that's, a joke, but that gives you the tenor of what he's trying to say. Now, when it comes to making you fail, that can sometimes be hard because you have intermittent failures. Because he points out that there are all sorts of things that go into intermittent failures. Okay, there are the initial conditions, input data, timing, outside processes, noise, temperature, vibration, network traffic, phase of the moon, and he says the sobriety of the tester. Okay, all these things sort of go into what makes for an intermittent failure. So how do you deal with intermittent failures? He says, first off, the easy way to do it is look at it every time it runs. Make it run again and again and again and look at every single run, okay? And then ignore all the good runs, okay, is how you do it. Okay, keep track of everything. Don't just write down all the bad runs. Write down all the good runs and the bad runs and then figure out what the bad runs are and then eliminate the others. Collect information on every run to do that, okay? Now, here's an example of intermittent failures and how fun it can be. This is a cool URL. At some point, you should read how they actually write it, but how many people in this room know what Cartalk is? Yeah, this is my kind of crowd. For those of you who don't know, Cartalk is a radio show on NPR that people call in with their problems about their cars, and a pair of kind of smartasses, I think you'd say, Click and Clack, who are two longtime mechanics, attempt to help them debug the problem over the phone. And so they get the following problem. They said that somebody called in and said, I have an old car, it's a 1976, I forget what it was, car, and my problem is that I go for ice cream, okay? And I go for ice cream, it's in the summer, I go for ice cream, I drive up to the ice cream place, and I go in and I order one of three flavors, okay? I either order chocolate, vanilla, or, mint chocolate tofu chip, I think they say, or something, okay? Now, it's very strange because what I wind up finding is if I order chocolate or vanilla, okay, and I get in my car starts right up, and I drive away. If I order the mint chocolate chip tofu, okay, then my car refuses to start for a while and just goes brrm, brrm, brrm. And so can you help me understand why it is that when I order one flavor of ice cream over the other, my car has problems. And this was the task that they were given to ask. And so what they found out, does anyone here know what the answer to that might be? It's a little tricky. Yes, ma'am. Okay. This
problem was the odd flavor of ice cream.
Mm-hmm. This is precisely it. Okay, so the difference is that the other ones were pre-packed. So when I went to go get a pint of ice cream that was chocolate or a pint of ice cream that was vanilla, they had it there. But this mint tofu chocolate chip, they had to actually spend more time putting it into the container. And so my car sat out there longer. And as a result, it had vapor lock after that sort of thing. So sometimes, when you look at the stuff and when you look at problems like this, it doesn't make any sense at all why a flavor of ice cream might cause your car not to start. But if you look at other things associated with it, intermittent failure, sometimes it makes sense. And just for the pearl nuts in the audience, does anyone know what this particular piece of code does? I thought it would be important to just give you this so you could use it in your own programs. Here. Okay, those of you who are not clapping, what that will do is this will calculate, and it will do something if it is a full moon. Feel free to include it in your programs. Make them change their behavior. It's a useful piece of code. I'm sorry for you Python people. There must be a Python equivalent. I don't know what it is, or a Ruby equivalent. Try to do it in Shell, I guess, if you want. Okay. Okay, so one of the other rules was quick thinking and look. And so here's the story that he tells. He says that he had a friend in this book who they had a company and they had this weird thing going on because they found that at approximately 11 o'clock every night, one of their servers went down. Okay? And they spent forever looking at the logs. They swapped out memory. They swapped out disks. They swapped out these sort of things. And they couldn't figure out. There was nothing in the logs that made any sense. It looked fine. Everything was running. They looked at the process table. You know, they logged in remotely. They made sure that everything was fine. They looked at this sort of thing. And so finally, one of the engineers who just got sick and tired of this decided what he was going to do, and I think it was he in this story, was he was just going to stay very late at night one night. Okay? So he stays very late at night, and he finds out that at 11 o'clock at night, he looks over. The server stops. He's sitting in his cubicle. The server stops. You know, he's working his cubicle. He finds the server stopped. He looks over the cubicle and he sees the janitor over near the plug, reaching. And apparently, the janitor had pulled the plug to put his vacuum cleaner in its place, to vacuum whatever that area was. Okay, and did this approximately 11 o'clock. And because no one had complained, thought that was fine. You know, it's perfectly fine. Unplug it. Okay. So unless you're actually looking at the problem when it's happening, you may not actually see what's going on. Okay? Now, how do you know when you can stop this process of looking and you can start theorizing? He asserts you should keep looking until the failure you can see has a limited number of possible causes to examine. Okay? Keep on looking until you can come to a limited number of things you could possibly then investigate versus the, I have no idea what the hell is going on. And, you know, and at that point, you know, you can start working more deeply. Instrument the system if at all possible. We all know that, okay? Instrumenting the system doesn't mean that you can use a debugger with it. It is pointed out that, and you have all had the same issue, I know I have, that when you start to use a debugger, it often changes the timing of what is going on, and the bug goes away. Right? Have you had that situation where you try to debug something, and you put a debugger, and it goes away, and that's why they call it a debugger? Right? Okay? So they don't count. For the divide and conquer rule, the suggestion is one way to figure out where a problem is, and this was kind of cool, is to try, when you're working with it, to inject easy-to-spot patterns. It's so much easier to figure out where something is going on if you're pumping something into the system that you can spot easily. So much easier. Fix the bugs you know about. This is a controversial thing. I don't think I agree with it, okay? That suggests if, as you're debugging something, you find other bugs that you know about, you should fix those first. I think that's a bad idea, but I'm telling you what's here, okay? I'd be interested to know whether you agree or disagree later, okay? Fix the noise first. The notion is that some things are, there are some bugs that are guaranteed to cause other bugs, and if you find them, maybe you should fix those first because they will take some of the noise out of your problem. Probably, maybe, I might believe that. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about change one thing at a time. Okay, there's a couple of pieces to this that will be useful if you know. First off, isolate the key factor. That's a pretty obvious one. This is one that I really love so much. This is probably well worth the buying the book. So if you want to have this, you should buy the book. He says, grab the brass bar with both hands. Now, what does that mean? And I'm going to read you his section just from the book just so you can understand because he writes it so well. On nuclear-powered subs, there's a brass bar in front of the control panel for the power plant. When status alarms begin to go off, the engineers are trained to grab the brass bar with both hands and hold on until they've looked at all the dials and indicators and understand exactly what's going on in the system. What this does is help them overcome the temptation to start fixing things, throwing switches and opening valves. These quick fixes confuse the automatic recovery systems, bury the original fault beneath an onslaught of new conditions, and may cause a real major disaster. It is more effective to remember to do something, i.e. grab the brass bar, than it is to remember not to do something, i.e. don't touch that particular dial. Okay? I think that's a brilliant metaphor. Tell that to all your friends. I love it a lot. i.e. hang on, stop, and wait until you understand what's going on before you start changing things. Okay? Hope that I can emphasize that enough. Also, when you're trying to figure out what's going on, change only one test at a time. If you change multiple tests at a time, you're not necessarily going to know what you're going to get there. If you happen to have another version that you can compare it against to see how a good one that works, and then compare it to this broken one, try that as well. And finally, this is another obvious one, but you'd be surprised how people don't think about this. Determine what you changed since the last time this worked. That's often kind of hard. I think it's a little naive because it assumes that you changed it. Okay, someone may have changed it, and I love going where you talk to them, and then usually about an hour in, they go, "Oh, did I mention I happen to have upgraded the operating system?" You know, and it happens to me all the time, and it's really frustrating. If, in fact, you are going to ask someone to look at something with you, make sure you report to them the symptoms and not your theories about what is going on. Okay? That is really how you get a fresh view versus, here's what I think is going on, what do you think? Okay? Now let's talk a little bit about the stuff from the Debugging by Thinking book, which is meant to be a multidisciplinary approach. And by that, they say that you should learn to debug like a detective, or debug like a mathematician, or debug like a safety expert, or debug like an Egyptian. I'm sorry, that was just a joke. It's just a pop culture reference. I hope you get it. If you don't, turn to the nearest person from, when is that? Debug like, anyway. Debug like a psychologist, debug like an engineer in the horrors of all horrors, debug like a computer scientist. Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. Okay? So let's talk debugging like a detective. One part before I get to that. So debugging, and here's a key thing to know. Do you have mail or something? Because you know you can get that little voice instead. Versus the sound of the power drill doing the auto-trepanation thing. Okay, so let's get back to my talk. Debugging is cognitive. It is not constructive. You are not building something. So as a result, building something, techniques and stuff like that, and ways of thinking about it, if you're thinking about it as constructive, it's not a constructive act. It is a cognitive act. It is thinking about what already exists. Okay. And the question is, people get debugging and testing confused. Okay. Testing is the process of determining whether a given set of inputs cause an unacceptable behavior in a program or in a system. Okay. Debugging, on the other hand, is the process of determining why that given set of inputs causes unacceptable behavior in a program and what you have to do to change it to fix it. Okay? Two different things. Testing and debugging are not the same thing. Now, people typically go through, as they learn how to debug, this cycle where they learn the following. First, they start off by this thing called debugging by editing, as this author says. And debugging by editing is I'm going to sit down, oh, it's got a problem, okay, I'll put more print statements in it. Okay, it's got a problem, okay, I'll just keep on changing the program and changing the program and changing the program until I finally get it fixed. Okay, that's what people do when they first start out in this field. You've done it yourself, okay? And then they go, well, maybe this isn't the most efficient way to do it. Maybe I can debug by interacting. And that's when you say, okay, what I'll do, and this is probably a slightly better thing, is I'll whip out the debugger, okay? And I will sort of use this debugger to step through, and I will take the existing stuff, and I will interact with it in some way, and then think more about it, okay? As you get more advanced, you start picking up little tricks about things that might help you debug, okay? And you get this bag of little tricks. Oh, well, you know, if I try this, or I put this, you know, if I put printfs around this, that'll work, or if I do this work. And so eventually you start getting to this point where you start repeating, you know, you basically have this bag of tricks, you pull out your bag of tricks, and all you know is, these things help me. You don't know why they help you when you work, but you haven't thought about it, but you just pull out these things and you start using those things that you learned. And then finally, the theory is you might be able to get to this mythical state called debugging by thinking, where you actually know what you're doing. You're actually thinking about what you're doing and why what you're doing will help. Okay, and that's some of what we're going to try to help you get to in this talk here, maybe. I don't know. Okay, so if you want to debug like a detective, you should look at people like Sherlock Holmes. And Sherlock Holmes, when he is looking for to solve mysteries, debugging like mysteries, kind of, uses cross-disciplinary knowledge, we all know that, and a little bit of cocaine, but that's neither here nor there, focuses on facts, pays attention to unusual details and absence of unusual details. Did the dog not bark? Gathers facts before making hypotheses, and I could give you, you know, wonderful Sherlock Holmes quotes, but you know this stuff because you all read Sherlock Holmes. States the facts to someone else. Okay, I don't know if you've noticed that. Starts by observing what's going on. You see, but you do not observe. Doesn't guess. Excludes the alternative explanations first, and reasons in both directions. You know, goes from conclusion, you know, working from things up to conclusion, from conclusion back to the things, and watches for red herrings. Now, when you're trying to do this sort of data collection as a detective for debugging, there are a few things you can do. You can try to gather data using something called sampling, where you try to get event-based stuff, or you do interval-based, you know, you pull individual things, you gather data like that. Sometimes you accumulate data over time, and you try to summarize it as you take it in. Okay, that's often called reduction. And the thing is that they have their pluses and minuses. Event-based is precise but can take longer. Sampling is approximate but it can take less time. Tracing is complete but, you know, you get a hell of a lot of stuff. If you reduce it as you take it in, well, you don't have as much stuff, but, you know, you lose details. You know that stuff. Okay? And so the other thing to pay attention to when you're doing this is that you sort of have the, I can take individual events or I can try to average stuff over time. You know, synchronic versus diachronic. Once you have some notion of what's going on and you're trying to figure out, you can then decide how you're going to describe it to yourself or to others. You've got the black box method. You can say, I've got input, I've got output, and here's how they deviate, in my opinion. You can pretend you're a scientist and say, here is my observation, here is my hypothesis, and here is an experiment I can try to fix it. You can try the reporter's method, who, where, why, what, what's going on, try to report that to someone. Or you can pretend you're a tester and say, here's my test case, here's what I think it should be by a reference, and here's the delta between those two. Now, for the next part about the detective, I want to introduce you to a person by the name of Professor Solomon. Professor Solomon, to my knowledge and to his knowledge, does not actually work at a university or have any sort of advanced degree, but yet calls himself Professor Solomon. Professor Michael Solomon, I think he went to Harvard, but I'm not sure about that. And he wrote this book called How to Make the Most Out of a Flying Saucer Experience. That, unfortunately, is not the book we're going to be talking about. The book we'll be talking about is a book that actually is kind of cool, and you might want to consider it, called How to Find Lost Objects. And in it, he has 12 ways, by Professor Solomon. It's available on at booksellers near you, or on Trey's system, whatever it's called. How to Find Lost Objects. Okay. So he has 12 rules on how to find anything that gets lost. And here are his rules. One, don't look for it. What he means by that is don't start looking until you have some vague notion as to where it might be. Stop, figure that out first, and then start looking. It's not lost, you are. Okay? And the theory is that there are no missing objects, only unsystematic searchers. Okay? Remember the three C's, comfort, calmness, and competence, because your state of mind when you're going to look for something matters a lot. It's where it's supposed to be. Look there first. It's where you left it. It's where it's supposed to be. It's what you'd expect. Look for domestic drift. What he's suggesting is that in a household, okay, things are at a specific place, and often they're near that specific place, but they may not be actually where you expect it. So, you know, my keys are supposed to be over on the mantelpiece, but they're not, but maybe they're over on the chair near that, okay? You're looking right at it, okay, and that's often really true. Or there's a camouflage effect going on. There's something on top of it. There's a piece of paper on top of it, and that's why you can't see it. Or there's something that's when you're debugging a system that's masking it for you. Think back to where you were when it was, you know, or think back to what possibly could have happened. Look once and only once, but look well when you look, okay? Because if you spend all your time looking over the same thing again and again and again, well, that's not going to help you all that much. There's something called the Eureka Zone, in his terms. The Eureka Zone is this area around approximately where you would expect to size something, but it's a little larger than where you'd expect to find it, and it's often sort of like, you know, right near it, okay, that there's this sort of zone of where you're most likely to find it. Tail thyself, okay, figure out where you were, pretend you're a detective, stuff like that. And finally, it wasn't you. Somebody may have taken it. Somebody may have changed your code. Somebody may have done something to the system. It might not have been you. Figure out who that is. Now, if we start wanting to think like a mathematician, there is a fabulous book called How to Solve It, which was written in 1945, still available in print, about how to teach people how to write mathematic proofs, okay, and how to think in a mathematic way. And it's kind of cool. His system is as follows. One, understand the problem. And he has also lots of good questions about this. That's not the one that I'm, that's not the interesting question that I think out of this. He says, find the connection between the data and the unknown. You may be obliged to consider auxiliary problems if an intermediate connection cannot be found. Immediate connection cannot be found. You should eventually obtain a plan to find out the solution. Now, that sounds all well and good, but to do that, you know, he gives this lovely set of questions like, have you seen it before, or have you seen the same problem? The mic sounds slightly different to me. Have you seen it before? Have you seen the same problem in a slightly different form? Do you know of a related problem? Do you know of a theorem that could be useful? Look at the unknown. Can you think of a familiar problem that has the same unknown? Okay. How is this problem solved related to something you've solved before? Can you use its result once you solve the problem? What else goes into it? Can you restate the problem differently? Can you solve the proposed problem by trying to solve some related problem? Can you change the unknown or the data or both if necessary to make them come closer to each other? So it's kind of cool. And once you've got that, easy. Carry out your plan. Okay? So it's kind of a cool book. I highly recommend it. I should have brought it with me to show it to you, but there it is. Oh, and finally, when you're done and you've carried out your plan, make sure your solutions make sense. Now, to this end, there is something worth saying about separating the notion of tactics, heuristics, and strategies. Tactics are those programming skills that produce information. Okay? That's basically just a good definition. Are there programming skills that you have that can produce more information in a situation when you're trying to debug? Those are what you can do. Okay? Heuristics are those techniques that you use when you're in an unknown situation. You don't know what's going on. There must be some technique. There must be some heuristics you can use to try to figure out, to try to produce stuff when you're when you're trying to solve. Okay? These are ways of making progress in those situations. And finally, you have strategies, which are sort of the global decisions on which tactics and which heuristics you're going to use. Now, how do you know if it's working? Because I think it's important to talk about this. How do you know when your debugging strategy is working, right? Okay. How do you know? Well, one theory is that the number of plausible hypotheses that have already been disproved should be increasing. Okay. The effort required to reproduce the problem should be decreasing. If you're getting there and you're getting closer, your ability to reproduce it should be easier. The size of the input you need to reproduce the problem should also be decreasing. Okay? Think about how you go about debugging something, right? Originally you've got this big, you don't really know how to do it, and you try all these things, and eventually you start narrowing down the set of what you have to do to make the thing happen. Okay, and what input you have to feed. And the amount of code, again, this is for, largely programming, but you can imagine this could be anything else. The amount of components in your system or the amount of things in your infrastructure. Well, the things that you're paying attention to the things you're not paying attention to should be increasing. Okay? Just a way to know. So let's assume that you have an unfamiliar problem. What are some heuristics you can use to try to figure out and to make it better? One, modify the program so that you can repeat the problem at will. This is a thing called stabilizing the problem. I think it's a fabulous term, and you should think about it when you're doing it. Can I stabilize what is going on such that I can make it behave the way I want it to instead of being sort of as intermittent? Create a test case that will demonstrate the problem when you want to. Okay, that's another way that might help you. Reproduce the input required to reproduce the problem. Oh, sorry, reduce the input required to reproduce the problem. Right, we talked about that. Categorize the problem according to a standard set of questions. I think this is an interesting one that many people haven't done yet, and we should be thinking about it. And similarly, can we describe the problem according to some standard methodology? Now, I know people go, blah, more documents, ISO 9000, blah, blah, blah. But is there a way that you could describe the problem that you could tell somebody else in the system admin world, and they would know precisely what you're talking about because you do it in a standard way? Explain the problem to someone else. Recall a similar problem from that past. That makes sense. Draw a diagram. Okay, that's another one people often don't think to do. And finally, choose a hypothesis from historical data. Let's assume that I have historical data. What happened in the past? What can I do with it? Okay. Now, right about now, I hear that, you know, the level of heavy breathing in the room has gone down, and so you guys are probably going to riot in a second if I don't actually bring up the sex. And here he is. This is old Scarlett, the Peterborough sexton. I mean, because what other clip art slide am I going to use for, like, where's the sex, okay? This is my problem, as I was trying to put this talk together. I mean, the best I can do is that. Does that help at all? Okay, I mean, I'm sure I could have found plenty of other pictures having to do with sex, but you know, I don't do yet. Well, you know, this is actually going to be required dress for Lisa 05. So I just, you know, I had to go test it out, so there it is. Okay, now, here's the important thing. When I start getting into the sex stuff, I need you not to try to take this analogy and, like, rugby, run in, I don't remember which direction, you know, whatever it is, it's a counterintuitive one. You know, take it and run in an opposite direction, okay? Let me control the horizontal and vertical for you on this analogy for a moment. Because if you... What? Why is this funny? Just because I use, you know, outer limits. Okay, anyway. Okay, because if I don't, okay, you're going to wind up with this picture in your head. Okay? Okay, I am not trying to equate people with machines. Machines don't have sex. Sometimes people don't either, but people don't have sex with machines. Well, I guess sometimes they do, but people, you know, okay, just hang tight, okay? It's important to realize, let me try to lead you to where I'm going. If you want to later on go off on your own, as we talked about before, fantasy is a fine thing, okay? Just hang on for a second. Let me do the driving here, okay? No, bad, bad analogy. Just to help you with that, let me remind you why we're caring here. We're dealing with complex systems, us sysadmins and them, with complex systems without authorship or control. Things should just work. They, and here's where we're going to start getting interesting, and here's where I'm going to start heading out of the area that we were just talking about. This stuff having to do with plain old debugging from this book, okay? We're chucking that now, okay? And we're going to start to do more sophisticated stuff, okay? One of the ways we're going to do it is to focus on relationships. We're going to focus on context as well in a way that we're not doing right now. Now, to do that, I have to tell you about a little bit what a sex therapist is. Some of you know, some of you don't know. Fundamentally, they deal with psychosexual dysfunction issues and psychosexual reproductive health issues and other stuff around this stuff. I say psychosexual because one of the things that will happen when you're dealing with sex therapy is they'll make sure that you've had some sort of medical checkup and that what is going on for you or going on for your couple isn't directly medically related. Is there something that we can do to help you with this? You don't have some sort of urological problem or some sort of vaginal issue or something like that, okay? And that's one of the things that they will do. Now, they do mostly work with partners, okay? Because sex is mostly about partner stuff. Is for me, largely. Maybe it's not for you. But mostly, we're talking about partner stuff, okay? And you're going to see why that matters to me in a moment. And an interesting question is, what's the difference between a sex therapist and a couples therapist, if that's true? And the answer is, don't get sex therapists in a room and ask them this question, because they will start to fight with each other. The sex therapist will fight with the couples therapist and et cetera like that. The sex therapist will say, no. Some of them will say, sorry, let me not put them all. Some of them will say, no, this is a special, this is a special field. We have special knowledge. We do special things. The couples therapist will say, no, you don't. This is just about, couple stuff having to do with sex. Okay? The people that I talked to largely fell in the second camp that said, couples therapists can deal with sex. Yes, it helps to have a little training and stuff like that, but there it is. Now, this might sound like a little bit of an echo from past things, like what's the difference, in sysadmin stuff, how do sysadmins distinguish themselves, or how is a network administrator different than a sysadmin? Don't know, let's not talk about that now. But that's something to know as I'm talking about this. So if this looks a little bit like couples therapy, don't be surprised. Okay, now, before I go and talk about this stuff, I think it's important for me to let you know that sex therapy has its own problems, and they admit to it. And I think it's good to air their dirty laundry here, because they're not here, and, I can do that. Okay? First, they think that there is no unifying theoretical base to their work. Okay? They don't have a unifying theoretical base.
By the way, neither do we.
But, okay... Theorists' assumptions are laden with sexual myths and stereotypes on things like gender and normalcy. You would hope that they would be more enlightened than they are, but they're not, and they admit to it. Current practices are based on gender-biased, phallocentric, and heterosexist assumptions. For example, rapid ejaculation in males is seen as a serious problem, whereas rapid orgasm in females is seen as a reason for celebration. Basic conception of sexuality remains biologically based, rather than offering equal attention to personal and interpersonal processes, cultural norms, and gender bias. They're still stuck in the body part stuff. Field continues to focus on body parts rather than the people attached to them. Still true, as far as I can see. And they feel that, or at least this person, Kleinpath, feels that they are least successful where the greatest needs are in sex therapy these days. And that's having to do with problems relating to desire. They don't know how to fix that either. They work on it, and they do really good jobs on it, but they don't know that either. Okay. What I want to do is, as I was reading through all the literature, and I did a hell of a lot of reading stuff, I looked at how different sort of parts of the field dealt with this stuff. And so the thing is when you get that notion that couples therapists can do sex therapy, and sex therapists, you know, use different theoretical models and stuff like that, you start looking at all the different things that are out there, you know, Freudian and Gestalt and all this stuff like that. And the one that stuck out for me that would be most useful for this talk is something called brief therapy. And we'll talk about what brief therapy is. If you're interested in brief therapy or brief sex therapy, this is an excellent book, okay? This is a superb field. You probably hard to read. It's called Quickies, is the name of the book. The Handbook of Brief Sex Therapy. Okay? And it's a fabulous, good survey of that field. Okay? Brief therapy is actually an umbrella term for a certain Batesonian, Ericksonian influence tradition of brief therapy, is what they call it. Basically, Gregory Bateson, if I understand correctly, was a fairly brilliant scholar. You should look him up on Wikipedia. And he was working with people like Van Neumann and other people who were doing communications theory. And his question was, could we apply some of the communications theory to people and stuff like that? And he worked with Erickson, who was a brilliant psychologist and hypnotist. He came up with Ericksonian hypnosis. And together, they sort of worked towards a thing they call brief therapy. Brief therapy is a little bit of a misnomer in that it's not just the notion that you have small number of sessions, but they said perhaps what we should have called it is effective therapy, which, you know, tends to actually piss off the rest of the therapeutic world when they say that. Okay, but the notion is it might be possible to do therapeutic work in more and, you know, not 15 years of lying on a couch or even long sessions. Now, why did I pick this particular flavor of therapy versus the other ones? I happen to have a bent towards the Gestalt stuff myself also. But why did I pick this one? Well, it's the easiest fit for SysAdmin timeframes. When I say we're going to talk about therapy, and you don't have this notion that every week I bring the computer into my office. You know, I have an hour and a half session for, you know, a year and a half until we make some progress, right? So you really would like it if we could figure out how to use some of this stuff immediately. I find some of the stuff that it says is provocative, and, you know, everyone needs provocative at this time of morning. And there's this cool thing called common factors research. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, and I think you'll find this really kind of cool. So one of the things that has gone on in the medical world is this cool thing called HMOs and insurance companies. And what insurance companies and HMOs really want is you to get as little therapy as possible or as little medical care as possible because that costs money. And they don't like that. So one of the things that there's been a pressure on the field to do is figure out what actually is it about therapy that works. Can we make therapy work better? I mean, it sounds a little bit like computer people, right? But this is being driven by a nasty opinion, industry that's trying to get people to have fewer sessions and stuff like that. So what can we do? So people have said, well, it would be very interesting to look at all the different kinds of therapy out there and try to figure out whether there are things in those particular types of therapy that are in common that work. What are the things that you can find in common amongst these different kinds of therapies, okay, that are effective? Okay, what are those things that work? So they did significant amounts of study, and here's how they found out. Here's what they broke it down as. Okay, so the breakdown goes like this. First off is what they call extra-therapeutic factors, and that's essentially the clients, okay? The view of the process of their therapy, the cognitive style, their expectations about what's necessary to change, and that makes up for about 40% of what really works in therapy. 40% of that is the clients, okay, and what the clients think are going to happen, okay? 30% is this core, are core elements of this therapeutic relationship. You know, you form a relationship with your therapist and together you work, okay? 30% is what, that, you know, that mattered, okay? What matters here. 15% is this thing that they call the placebo effect, which means that both the client and the therapist think that change is possible and that it will happen, okay? 15%. And now, the remaining 15% is what type of therapy you actually do. Okay? It is only, in their opinion, 15% which kind of therapist you pick. If you have the other things, and granted, some of the other things, you can find, you know, for whatever problem you have, you can find them more or less, you know, you can feel, have a better therapeutic relationship from using different other, you know, you might match better with a particular kind of therapy, but ultimately, the kind of therapy that you go to seek doesn't really matter. Okay? So I picked this one. There we go. That's what we're going to talk about. You could pick another one. It wouldn't ultimately really matter. How's that for feeling good? Okay, so what I want to do is show you some of the different brief therapy ideas that come up. And I'm going to try to relate them as I go to system administration. Okay? So Bill O'Hanlon, and when I put a name up there, that's the name that is that comes from the person who wrote the chapter in this book, just so I can be referencing something you can read later. Okay? So Bill O'Hanlon has something that he calls possibility therapy. And here are the tenets of possibility therapies in two slides. I put little red check marks next to the ones that I think are directly related to system administration. First off, people are influenced but not determined by their past. People are influenced by their sense of what is possible for their future. At any moment, unless physically compelled by someone who holds power over them, or unless they are prevented by physical incapacitation, people choose the actions they take. It's a little dramatic, but it's true. People are more likely to cooperate when they and their feelings and points of view are validated and respected. Therapists can never know the truth about people. Therapists can never know the truth about people because we are always influencing what aspects of the truth get spoken and heard. System administrators in this brave new world may not always know the truth because we are always influencing what aspects of the truth get spoken and heard. No one knows for certain what causes certain behavioral, psychological, or emotional, or relational problems, although there is no shortage of people who claim to know. True? What we do in therapy either works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, it's best to first try something different rather than deciding the person, the couple, the family is unmotivated or unable to change. In system in world, if you try something, just assuming that it's broken and it'll never be fixed, not so good, but it's a very easy attitude to have. There are many pathways to change. No one technique, method, or philosophy works for everyone, despite many claims to the contrary. You important? What creates, okay, and this is going to be a little funky, and let me see if I can give you an example of this to do this in sex therapy. I'll give you the sex therapy example. What helps create change is not always an indication of what caused the problem. That's a very dramatic statement, and if you're not falling over into your laptop right now with that, okay, you're not paying attention. What actually creates the change in a situation may not have anything to do with what the problem really was. An example for that is, let's assume that you're treating somebody with erectile difficulties, okay? Can help that person get over those may not have anything to do with what actually gave that person the problem. Okay, but ultimately, if the goal is to create change and to help with that problem, maybe it doesn't matter that it wasn't what caused the problem in the first place. Now I'm starting to get provocative at you. Hope you're not going to get provocative at me. All experience is okay. Actions are either okay, ethical, safe, etc., acceptable, or not. Okay? There's a difference between people's experiences and their actions. Same in debugging world. Okay, next theory. This is a cool one. I think you might find fun. So a gentleman by the name of James Prochaska decided what he wanted to do was study, and I think this is a fascinating question, the puzzle of how people intentionally change their behavior. Okay? Somehow, people seem to change their behavior. Somehow, things get better. We go through life, things get better. How does this happen? Sometimes it happens without us doing anything. A problem happens, and it gets better. How did that happen? He makes the observation that at different stages, people apply particular processes to progress to the next stage. Okay? Making things better as you're going through these different stages and conceptualizing these things as stages where there are different stages that you are moving through thing after thing after thing, going from one stage to the other may require something different for every stage. Similarly, debugging, when you're going through a set of stages, you may have to use different techniques, approaches, thoughts about it to move from stage to stage. And the other thing to realize that he's found out is that when he talks about these different stages, they are not necessarily linear. It's not necessary that you go dum 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 dum. Okay? It is often the case, in fact, more likely the case, that you're going to go dump dump up, back some, dump dump, back some, dump 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 dump, back two, dump dump dump. You know, and it's not a linear thing. Okay? And anyone who has done any therapy at all knows that that's probably true. First stage, pre-contemplation. Okay? Pre-contemplation is the stage where the person doesn't actually even know that they want to change. I mean, they might be there because someone has told them they should be in therapy, but they're not quite sure. They haven't really thought about what it means. Okay? And in those cases, what you need to do is, they say, have a light hand, i.e., just give them some idea of what what changing could be like. Not what any specific change would be like, but just, would changing be useful to that person? Okay? Then people move, and again, this is like the Kubler-Ross stages. It's not necessarily linear, so don't take them directly linear, but there's some assertion that they're close to linear. Okay? There's this notion with contemplation, okay? You move to the next one. That's where someone's thinking about changing, okay? And these are typically the people that are the most annoying to deal with, okay? Quite frankly. Because they're the ones that vacillate back and forth. No, I want to change. Yes, I do. No, I don't. Yes, I do. No, I don't, okay? But they're thinking about it, and you just have to kind of sit with that. Now, an interesting question is how to apply this to system in therapy. Keep on thinking. Keep a theory. Keep on thinking. I'll try to wrap that up when I get to the end of these stages. Person wants to change, they're certain. Now it's time for them to try to change, okay? And so they're going to prepare to change, and so what you do with that person is you start scheming about specific ways to make those changes. That's preparation. Finally, you get to action. Now, here's the cool thing. When people think about therapy and they think about things getting better, people think this is the stage that matters, okay? That this is the only one of the stages in your therapy that matters, the actions that you have taken. Okay, that's their thought. What the people think therapy is. I walked in, I did something, I made a change. I made a change in my life, and that's what really mattered. I want to point out to you that's not necessarily the case. Okay, and one of the things that's important when you're thinking about debugging is the changes you just, the making changes is not the most important part necessarily of debugging. Then, after presuming this works, you then have to work towards maintenance. Okay, this notion of keeping whatever changes you make still going and going well. Okay. And then finally, you get to something called termination, which means something slightly different in our field than it does in the therapeutic field. Okay? And there's some notion that this is just a goal. Maybe people don't actually really get to this sort of thing. Okay. So how does this go towards system in stuff? Well, my assertion is that you might want to start thinking about system administration debugging as having stages as you're going through it, and that those stages don't necessarily have the same techniques, you don't do the same things to move from one to the other, and you might be going back and forth through those stages. Solution-focused brief therapy, and now I'm going to start getting really controversial. This is by DeShazer. He says that you are moving away from problem-solving and towards solution-building. It doesn't matter that you know what the problem is. It doesn't matter that you don't spend all this time trying to figure out what was that one root cause, what caused the problem. Okay? You are more working on what are the things that will make this better? What is the solution to the problem? Independent of trying to spend a lot of time to figure out what was the problem. Now, I've just said something that should get you like bringing out the pitchforks, okay, and the torches. Okay? I'm suggesting to you, and I don't know if I believe it myself, that maybe one of the things as we start getting more sophisticated in the realm of system administration is you might not actually have to know what the problem is to fix it. Okay? And when you get to be more with more sophisticated systems, it may not matter. Bless you to everybody who's sneezing. See, this is how I know that it's working. Okay? You may not have to know what the problem is, and it may not matter. It just may matter that you have worked towards a solution and fixed it. Okay? That's very controversial, and it gave me the heebie-jeebies when I first started to think about this, and it should start getting you up in arms as well. Now, solution-focused brief therapies assume problems are not always present, okay, or they're present in the same way, and they use that fact. They look for absence in the problems, lowered intensity of the problems, or times when the problems are present, or something is the same things are going on, but it's not a problem, and they utilize that situation in what they're doing. And one of the things they often do is they use this something. Some of them use a system called EARS. You elicit what is better from the client. Once you figure out what has better, you know, that has gone better, you then try to amplify that change. Once you amplify that change, you try to reinforce it so that they're doing more of it or they can continue to do it. And then you start over and ask, what else is the problem? I'm going to start to get more controversial as I go on. The Mental Research Institute has been working for a very long time on this brief therapy stuff. One of the things that they think is very important is that you need to try to disengage the things that you are trying to do to solve the problem from the problem itself. And that often, those attempts to solve the problem sometimes make the problem worse, or often, with people, make the problem worse. Okay? And that really one of the biggest problems here is not necessarily that you have this problem, but it's that you're locked into this really tight cycle. Okay? You've got this tight loop going on with your problem and your way to solve it. So you know people who you see them in their lives where they try to fix something and you see them do something and it doesn't work and they try harder and they do it again and they do it again and they do it again and it just gets worse or they get more frustrated and things just get worse. Okay? So if you can disengage the problem from its attempted solutions, you might have the freedom to look at it in a different way. Okay? One way to do that is to change the meaning ascribed to the problem so you might be able to bring to it a different class of solutions. One of the ways that they like to do this is using something called the miracle question. And the miracle question, I have the full one as it would be done by one of those therapists, but I'm just going to give you the version of it, the short version of it. It goes a little bit like this. Okay, so let's say tonight you go home, you don't do anything special, you watch TV, you do whatever, you have dinner, you go to bed, okay? You sleep soundly, and then strange enough, you wake up in the morning, and in the morning when you wake up, the problem is gone. A miracle has happened, the problem is gone. Okay? You have no idea what happened or how it happened. How would you know that the problem is gone? How would you know? What would be the first sign that things were better? Okay? That's the attempt. The attempt is to get you to figure out how would you know, what would be the very first thing, because this is often really hard. How could you tell that the problem is better or that you are moved towards that? How are things better? And it is interesting what you get out of that particular question. Okay, what if a miracle happened and things were better? Now, in computers, you might think that this is more an easy question to answer. I woke up and all of a sudden my DNS started working, but that's old school. I assert to you that as time goes on, it's not just going to be binary, okay? Knowing when the problem is gone or what the first sign of things getting better in your universe is going to become harder for you to figure out, and trying to think first of how will I know is going to be more important to you. Now, what do they do once they've asked you a question? Well, there are a few things that they do as interventions to try to help you with this. They tell you to do less of the solution behavior. Whatever you're trying to do, do less of that. Okay? That makes sense. You can see them saying that. If it's not working for you, do less of it. Or they tell you, do more of it. Okay? Try harder. Do more of it. You know, if you're trying to do it that, you're having problems with having sexual intercourse, have more sex. Have more sex. Just every night, okay? And then observe what happens. Okay? In the computer world, if you're having problems with throughput, try to jam more through. What do you observe? Okay? Do more of it. Do whatever you're doing differently. That makes sense. Or they also do stuff known as reframing. They do context creation. Reframing is this thing, you know, people talk about reframing, I never really understood it until I read this sort of stuff. Reframing is like when you're doing, when you get a camera, okay? And it's basically this notion that what I do is I move what I'm looking at just slightly enough such that things that used to be really clearly in focus to me now are less in focus and something else is more in focus, okay? I change where the frame is, okay? And the notion is that if you change that, it helps with the context. It helps you pay attention, you know, you're paying attention to different things, and the things that you thought were really important now maybe aren't really as important. And if you can move that frame or deconstruct it somehow, that helps a lot. And somebody in one of these books says, I find it a lot easier to help people change their picture rather than try to sell them a new one. It's a lot easier to reframe than just get rid of whatever's going on. Here's another cool idea from the people who wrote this book. Flemons and Green say that they are focused on shifting. They're focused on how the relationships between things shift around, i.e., the relationship between the two clients, the relationship between the clients and their problems. How can I change their relationship to their problems? And they note that whenever people try to just negate things or try to automatically, in the same framework they're in, try to make it stop or get better, often that makes it worse. And the way they do this is they say that problems are not localizable. Okay, it's not like you've got a couple, they're sitting in your office, and you can point to the problem. That the problem is a physical thing, or I can point to it, and there's just one problem. Okay, it's a system. It's a systemic view. Okay, it's a systemic view where the problem exists in the relationship versus in one discrete thing. And I assert to you, in the system administration world, we're going to have to start thinking like that. It's not this component, okay, that is going on, that has got the problem. It's not this disk drive that has decided to crap out, okay? It is something more than that. Relationships, and here's another cool one, relationships are most viable when the relata, I guess you'd say, which are the pieces of the relationship, you know, the two ends of the relationship, are able to move freely in relationship to each other. If you have this relation of freedom and you can move this around, you would be surprised how things get better. Okay? It's when things get stuck in relationships like this that you have the problem. Okay? And there isn't freedom to move around. There aren't ways to plan. There aren't ways to make things better. If you are really stuck, this server must be this way. This network must be this way. Then it makes it really hard. Okay? The catalytic approach suggests the following, and I like this one a lot. If you can introduce a small but significant shift in the relationship interactions or descriptions around a problem, then amplify the... You introduce a small but significant shift in the relationship interactions or descriptions around a problem, and then amplify the subsequent ripples in the system to foster change. Okay, we're starting now to talk about not broken components. We're starting to even more talk about the fact that you are dealing in your environment with a system. You're thinking systemically, okay? All these things that are in your environment that have to work together are systems. So the question is, if something breaks, can you make a small change in this system and then amplify the ripples that will happen from that small change to make things better? Okay? If by making a small change, things start to be different and you amplify that, maybe it will make the rest different. Okay? And the thing is that what we've been focused on as system administrators for the longest time is first-order change, okay? First-order changes are things within the normal definitions. You know, they're understanding premises rules, their practices, you know, frequency, how many times something happens, where it is, the intensity, location, duration, stuff like that. But really what we need to start thinking about is second-order changes, okay? This is where I'm starting to propose we need to start thinking for debugging. Second order changes, where it's not a change of intensity or a change of frequency, it's a change of what your premises are, it's a change of how you define things, your assumptions, your practices, your traditions of what's going on. You need to start thinking in a second order manner. Okay? And the way you can do this, for instance, is you can identify the vicious cycle pattern around the problem. Often problems have a vicious cycle associated with them. Okay? And often that vicious cycle, you tried something, you know, something went wrong, and you tried to fix it this way, it went wrong again, you tried to fix it this way again, it went wrong again, you tried to fix it this way again, and you've got a cycle going. If you can initiate a new action by redirecting the solution or attempting to reframe it, okay, you can break out of that. If you can identify and amplify exceptions to that, when things worked good, this is another really good thing that you can take from this talk. If you pay attention to the exceptions, if things don't break all the time, and you can pay attention to when they worked and figure out how to make them work more often, that might be another way to debug your system. And build on these exceptions to support change. Okay, I'm on my last sex therapy slide thing. I want to tell you a few, this is my fewer gleanings on this sort of stuff, and I'm watching carefully. We'll have a few minutes for questions. One of the things that I got from reading a bunch of stuff about sex therapy is that they pay attention to multi-contextual stuff. They pay attention to the notion that whatever's going on with this particular problem exists in a context, and that exists in another context, okay? Whatever that context may be, it could be contextually in you know, the fact that, I have this machine, it exists in this context where it's in this open source world. It also exists in this context where it's in this world of vendors who build things like this. On and on and on, multi-contextual. Sometimes it's really useful to understand, and the RFCs have always understood that sometimes you have to define what you need and what you want in interactions. The should and must, perhaps, but we don't always pay attention to that because some people think, you know, it is absolutely crucial that this server contact this server this way. Is that what you really need, or is that what you want to have happen? Sometimes when you're doing stuff in sex therapy, and you tell a couple to work on stuff, you have to tell one of the people in the couple you're in control of this particular thing. You have to tell, okay, you're in charge of initiating sex, okay? Because it doesn't always work that there should be some notion of peer stuff. So maybe it is the case that when you're debugging or you have a situation going on, you may need to give one of the two things more control. Maybe it needs to be this server, maybe, you know, I'm just making that part up. Something that's kind of fun that I read was when you talk about people with sex and you're trying to help them with their sex problems, often people tell them stop having sex or stuff like that. Or perhaps stop making DNS queries or whatever. You know, I'm trying to debug this. Stop, you know. And, you know, people attempt to fix a problem by saying, okay, everybody stop. But the thing is when you are helping someone with an eating disorder, you don't say, stop eating until we get this thing fixed, okay? Just stop eating, okay? It's a problem. Just stop. Okay? That doesn't always work. There are a couple of things that I learned from reading about sexual addiction that I thought you might find fun, interesting, useful to you. Okay? There are two mistakes that people make when they attempt to treat sex addiction that I have read about. Mistake number one is to teach the person to try to have sex like a normal person mistake. No, they're all hyphens between that. And by that, they try, okay, what I'm going to try to do is teach you to be able to stop and start your sexual urges, and I'm going to tell you that fantasies are fine, okay? Have fantasy, that's fine. Everyone does it. Just try to be like a normal person. But people who have this issue, A, if they could stop and start their problem, they wouldn't have sexual addiction. And B, fantasies for people who have sexual addiction aren't just fantasies. Often they're rehearsals, okay, for future behavior. So sometimes you have to do something really totally different. You have to really, so it's a contradiction to the previous one. Okay, sometimes you really do have to make things stop in a very dramatic way. The second thing that they make a problem with, or that they have a problem with, is the notion that you should, if you only help that person have better sex, if it was qualitatively better, okay, then they wouldn't have the sexual addiction. If somehow they had really good, fulfilling sex with someone that they loved in a relationship, things would be better. But the problem with this is like trying to help an alcoholic by taking him to a wine appreciation class. You know, this notion that if only they tasted really good wine, if they had the best Chardonnay possible, okay, they wouldn't really have this other behavior. And the thing is that sex addiction is not, you know, just like alcoholism is not a problem with beverage selection, okay? Sex addiction is not necessarily about that, okay? It's people acting, using through sex, you know, having problems that manifest through sex. It's not necessarily the sex itself. Okay? I read a great thing that talked about staircase wit. This particular person points out the following, and I think you can use this directly, that in a moment of intimacy, stuff like that, your perception and your ability to think narrows down. Now, I don't know about you, but I was going to say mine narrows down to a very small thing, right? Your ability to concentrate on this stuff. And so what will happen is that if you actually stop whatever is going on and you walk away for a little while, you will have what is known as staircase wit. Okay. All of a sudden, something makes sense to you now. All of a sudden, your consciousness has expanded for, you know, more than just in that moment. And so, if you're in the middle of debugging something, okay, and you can walk away for a little bit, that often helps a hell of a lot. One of the fun things, if you're dealing with couples, and this is something you should realize when you're dealing with things that have to interact in your environment, is that often things have reached a state of equilibrium. And if you're going to want to change one part of that relationship, often the other side will attempt to do something to compensate. Sometimes that other side in therapy, the other partner will attempt to sabotage the therapy because now all of a sudden things are changing. And this other person doesn't like the fact that we're coming out of equilibrium. Okay? Now, does that work in computer stuff? I think it does. I think you've seen situations where you're trying to make a change and the other thing starts going, blah, you know, and tries to work even harder to maintain what was going on. And finally, I want to read you a lovely quote because I like it a lot that says, if you ask a lot of questions, you get a lot of answers, but you may not hear what the problem is because you have not allowed the patient to tell you. If you ask a lot of questions, you get a lot of answers, but you may not hear what the problem is because you have not allowed the patient to tell you. Okay, so let's put the pieces together. Oh, so briefly? First off, I wanted to give you some notion, that thing I flung to the side about basic debugging. We need to start, you know, getting good at basic debugging and thinking about this. I gave you the basic level because I think that I'm not good at it either. Okay? But I think it's time to take it to the next level. I think that we need to start concentrating about systemic debugging, because quite frankly, we're doing assessments. Yes, thank you. And I think that we need to start thinking about things in a relational fashion, something we're not doing. What are the pieces? We are in the middle of these things. What are the pieces here? Here are the ideas we can steal to do it. Just being a third party watching an interaction can often help. I don't know if you ever watched your parents argue. Okay, you know how you'd fix it. Okay? And just being a third party gives you a whole new view, and there's systemic truths that we can be paying attention to. I don't know if you want to believe this. It's up to you. Maybe we need to stop focusing on our problems and trying to categorize problems and figure out what the problems are and be focused on the problems. Maybe we need to be focusing on solutions. I don't know. Feel free to come lynch me after this talk. That'd be fine. We need to think about relational freedom. If we can make the pieces move in a more free way, will that help? The notion of stages of change, and that there are rhythms debugging and that things work with certain rhythms. There's that miracle question, trying to find sizes of change. Thinking about second order debugging is important. And thinking about how we can use exceptions as we're doing in our debugging. How can we pay attention to exceptions and what they mean for us? Okay, therein lies the end of my talk. That was just a hint, but you don't have to. I want to point out that I read books and I talk to people. I want to thank just a few people. I want to thank Dr. Flemons and Green, who were kind enough to talk to me for an extended time about their book and their work and their field. I want to thank my spouse for letting me prattle on about this without doing too much eye rolling, which really went to an optometrist, you know, as a result. And I really want to thank Sage, Usenix, Liso, 4PC, and you guys for just listening to me make these wacky talks. I hope they do stuff. Okay, now I'll take questions and comments in the remaining 30 seconds. Trey, go ahead.
So, a quick comment and then a question. I think that some of these ideas are really important for how we deal with our management, specifically the miracle question, I think, is a really good example. If you can get buy-in from your management that when this telltale sign has happened, then we can move on. I think that's really important. And also this question about first and second order behavior and vicious cycles. I think that often you can get into a situation where you're so root cause driven that,
right.
You know, for instance, you have these 18 things that can cause your cash to invalidate. And so people want to know, well, how can we keep the cash from invalidating? Well, the cash is going to invalidate. You have to work about these other things surrounding it. My question is, If you fix it without knowing the problem,
go ahead.
That's okay for the individual case, but don't you have a lack of confidence and anxiety about the efficacy of your solution, and you're constantly worrying for the future about whether it'll just reappear?
Okay, so here's the deal. I asked that exact same question. The question is, and this is what made me nervous about this, I said, okay, if you don't know what the problem is, how do you know you fixed it? And how do you know it's not going to reappear? And they said to me this. There are a couple of things that go on. First off, when you're starting to work, solution-based therapy isn't finding just this one solution, okay? It's not finding, here's your magic button, take this thing, go away, and now it's fixed, okay? It's about making systemic changes, okay? If you've actually found a solution here, what you've done is made systemic changes, okay? Those systemic changes are more than likely going to prevent other problems from coming up because you've made fundamental systemic changes, in people at least, okay? Okay, so if you're thinking about it from a solutions perspective and you're finding the solution, it's not finding, like, I found a broken carburetor and I pulled the carburetor and I put a new one in and things are fine now. It's now carburetors don't break anymore. Okay? You know, the solution I found is a solution. It's not a specific solution. As long as you're thinking systemically. And that's what they said to me. They also said that you can be pretty darn sure, you know, when things are honestly truly fixed and as they are self-reported, you know, in people it's self-reported also. So I hope that helps. Thank you. One more, and then I think we should go our merry ways.
Yeah, hi. Christian Bauernfeind.
Hi, Christian.
Going back to your 10 methods of finding things,
yep.
I believe there's one more that you, well, not missed, but that's out there. Goes back to Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, I believe, and restated in a little more modern terms. It goes something like this. Say you've just disassembled your cell phone. Why? Because I can. You've used the watchmaker's toolkit, and now you've got this heap of tiny little screws. And of course, you drop one, and of course, the area is carpeted. And you probably don't have a chance in hell finding it by just getting your nose to the carpet and looking for it. But you still got this heap of screws, so you drop another one and watch it. And I have found stuff that way, and I don't know if there's a moral here, but I guess the one I can draw is that if you're trying to solve a problem by recreating it, make sure you've got the initial conditions right.
Yes, absolutely. Very good point. So I want to thank you folks for coming to see this, and I'm hoping that we'll have other great talks at LISA 05. If you're interested in proposing them, pretty please send mail to LISA 05 Cheer or the IT Chairs as well. They really want to hear from you. And have a great rest of the day and conference. It's been fabulous talking to you.